Tell us the worst Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? If during this interview my voice sounds a bit boomy, it's because I'm hiding in the loo in my house, trying to escape the noisy joie de vivre of my children as they, I don't know if they're trying to kill each other or, I don't know, amuse each other, but the sounds are pretty similar. And I don't know if you really want to hear them while I'm teeing up this chat that I had with Mary Wynne. So Mary, for those of you who aren't aware, is one of the best copywriters of her generation. You can take my word for that, or you can have a look at the work that I've put on my blog of hers, or you can just look at the pages of DNAD. She's had 3 writing nominations. I don't think there are many people who can claim to have managed that during their careers. So that's pretty impressive. But I think the other very interesting thing about Mary's career is that, you know, she and her partner Damon Collins worked for Dave Trott during his GGT heyday. Then they worked for Paul Arden during his Saatchi & Saatchi heyday. Then they went on to work for David Abbott when AMV was the best agency in the world. So Mary's got a lot of light to shed on those parts of the advertising industry, what it's like working for those 3 remarkable people, and what she learned from them, and how she brought it into her own career and writing. So without further, echoey jabbering from me, here's my chat with Mary. So hi, Mary. Thanks very much for making the time to speak to me. I hope you're well. This afternoon for you, isn't it, on Saturday?
It is. I don't know if you can see out the window behind, but it's dark, wet and rainy. So it is afternoon. It's only 4:30, but it is pitch black and dark because we are full winter here.
Yeah, it's not like that in LA. I won't tell you what it's like because you might feel a bit ill. And I'll just leave that information for myself. What I've done in all of these chats so far is to begin by asking people how and why they bothered to get into this industry in the first place. And I think everyone's got a different story. So what might yours be?
Well, I sort of would have said that I graduated in English and philosophy, thought I'd like to go into advertising, and I had a brilliant idea. I will do a secretarial course, or basically a typing course, and I'll go in as a secretary, and then they will recognise my genius quite quickly, and I will whiz up through the ranks. I had no idea about copywriters or art directors or account people. I just thought there's advertising agencies, they're in London, I'll go into one. So I ended up as a secretary to the head of sales promotion in McCann Erickson, which is probably not quite where I ended up. And after being a really bad secretary, as you can imagine, the average philosophy graduate is not the best at organising your lunches and your mistresses, as he had several, which I had to try and juggle. One of who was had the same name as his wife and was engaged to his brother.
Oh,
that was the 80s. Hey,
yeah.
I made a fuss and I was promoted to, I don't know, an account handler. And within a week of being promoted, I realised this was a big mistake and I was appalling at it and I hated it. And then I actually had a boyfriend at the time who said, hey, I've heard about copywriting. It's great. You know, you just make up stories and stuff. He was also a graduate. And so I went to Hounslow Borough College and did a copywriting course where and I studied all the annuals. You know, I'd heard about DNAD annuals, so I got them all. And I read through a lot and I was particularly keen on posters and writing and this sort of most succinct. And I found my all-time favourite poster from those days, and it was for Rawlinson's tonic water. And it said, "We knew how before you know who."
Mm.
You remember the Schweppes?
Yeah.
And it was just very close up on the label, established 1623, which is like 4 years before. I thought, God, that's amazing. Who's the copywriter and who's the art director? And both copywriter and art director were the same person. It was Ron Collins. So when I turned up at Hounslow Borough College and there's a Damon Collins on the course, so I kind of laser beamed in, checked it out. You didn't have Google in those days, but somehow managed to find out that he was Ron's son. And I'm not saying I really worked hard to work with him. He was actually also on the copywriting course, but I worked pretty hard to get together with him. And we did team up because he was actually quite arty. And we did get a lot of tuition from Ron Collins, and that probably helped.
That's quite interesting because, I mean, I don't know how many people listening have a thing about Ron Collins. Everyone I know has heard the sooty story about a million times of, I don't know if I'm going to do it justice, so I may not give it a go now. But Ron had a reputation as being, let's say, didn't suffer fools gladly. So what was it like getting some instruction off him?
Well, of course, like a lot of people who can be quite terrifying at work, he was utterly lovely at home. You know, he was a big family man. I mean, and Damien's mother had fairly recently divorced and he had married again. He had small children, but he had three children with Damien's mum and then two more with his next wife. And he was a very warm and open person. And he just loved advertising. I mean, he was obviously an amazing art director. I don't know if people listening, I hope they still remember him. They should do, certainly. But he was a great art director. But he was also wrote some very funny and very clever ads, such as the Cinzano ads with Leonard Rossiter. And he was a massive, not sure what the right phrase is, he really liked famous people. So he met and worked with Morecambe and Wise and James Hunt and all the kind of famous people of that era. We're going back to the 60s, 70s, I suppose, now. He was not at all hostile. He was really good at teaching us. And we used to go up there for Sunday lunch every Sunday, and we would bring our ads as though we were doing a review, and we'd have Sunday lunch, and then he would go through the ads and give us just advice, you know, not kind of like how to change an ad, but just, you know, how to get there. He wouldn't rewrite the ads, but he just kind of inspired us to get better and better. So he was a great, great influence on both of us.
And so how long was the Hounslow course? Was that a three-year thing?
It was there were only two courses then. There was Watford, which I'm sure is still going. Yeah. And there was Hounslow Borough, which then became Buckinghamshire, I think, or something like that.
Yeah.
And it was a two-year course, unlike the Watford one. But really, after the first year, then you got the placements, which was, I suppose, something that's still very important now. As soon as Dane and I started getting placements, we worked quite hard at trying to make those permanent features. So we ended up with a job, I think, at FCB, before we'd finished our exhibition or whatever you call it. And they said, if you don't come back and do your exhibition, you won't get your HND in copywriting. And then they realised that this was not a big threat. So they went, please come back and put some work up and we'll give you your HND in copywriting, because it was quite good for people to get jobs off the back of it, which most of us did. And so we did graciously go back and put up our work, and we got our whatever it was, HND. But we started work under Barry Smith at FCB, as was then.
I think Dave Trott put the story of this on his blog recently, or one of his blogs recently. I don't know if you saw that, but was it something along the lines of you said you'd work there for free, or there wasn't a job and you said you'd...
What we did was, it wasn't particularly clever, but it was sort of February, January time and snowy and cold, and we put up a tent outside each agency we wanted to work at. And everybody was going, so that must be retouched, obviously. They found a picture of the agency and then they took a photograph, and which is quite high tech in those days. But no, we put a tent up in the early hours of a Sunday morning when nobody would sort of arrest us. And then we sort of like put our little book sticking out of it, and it just said, we'll something along the lines of, we'll do anything to work here, or something like that. And that is true that Dave did write a blog about it and how determined we were to get in. But I actually said that I thought, oh no, we should have written the line, we're intent on getting but Dave would have hated that, because he hated puns. He called them the Englishman's disease. One of the couple of arguments that he and I probably had was about my love of puns.
So were you choosing, I mean, because FCB, I mean, I don't know if it had a good reputation at that time, or it was you chose the glamorous places you wanted to work, or how did that...
Gosh, We chose every place. This was one of many, many, many places. We probably just worked our way through the top 20. And strangely, FCB, it was on the turn slightly, to be honest. I think it had things like possibly British Airways or certainly had Cadbury's and some big accounts. And they were all on the slide slightly. I'm not dissing it because it was it was a great place and gave us a good opportunity. But it was that sort of era, early 80s, or no, mid 80s actually, when creative departments quite often were a little bit out of control. They were either highly controlled, like BBH or GGT or BMP or CDP, or they were sort of that other things where they were a little bit out of control. A lot of drinking went on and not a huge amount of work after lunch. And I think maybe our thinking sort of went, rather than trying to get into the hottest agency where we would be struggling behind a long, long queue, because it was still bloody hard to get in even then, why not try and weevil into the sort of middle or just the general melee, and perhaps we sort of pick up briefs where other people didn't want to do them rather than competing at the highest level. And that was our thinking. And it worked.
And this was like, what, about 1987 or 6? Or
yeah.
Yeah.
About 86, I think, yeah.
And that's where you did the Starvermeter poster that yeah. caught Dave's attention.
That's right. And it was a brief that had been given. London Transport was one of the accounts, which is a great account, and had been given to a senior team after lunch a week before. And that senior team had no recollection of ever having been given that brief. So the lovely account lady came upstairs to pick up the work, and I won't say who, I don't know if he's still around. John Sherfield was the team. He's got no recollection of this brief whatsoever. So, no, never heard of it. I know you must have imagined it. You certainly didn't brief me. So she came sort of in, we overheard, and knocked out some ads very, very quickly. And that's how it happened, basically. Starvermeter was one of them, of a few that went on to get in the book and also draw attention, more importantly, to us.
And so at that time, I think GGT was a pretty cool, interesting place to work, and it had a reputation, and Dave had a reputation. So how did you feel when you got that phone call?
Well, it was interesting because we actually, and this sounds incredibly braggy, but it was just unbelievably lucky. We got three job offers at the same time. The first one that came through was JWT. And I can't quite remember the name of the creative director there, but they offered us a job. They must have seen our book or something. And then Dave Trott also saw the poster and got our book in and offered us a job. And BBH, John Hegarty, offered us a job as well at the same time. That just kind of doesn't happen, does it? It was, as I say, it was certainly nothing that we were doing massively right. Just a bit of synchronicity going on there. And if it wasn't for the fact that Ron Collins was still very much our mentor, I think we'd have gone to BBH, because even then, well, especially then, it's highly glamorous and a great agency, and still is. And, you know, my one regret is that I never worked there. But he said, you should work for Dave Trott. Ron worked with Dave Trott's wife, I should say, Kathy Heng. So he knew Dave, not as personal friends perhaps, but certainly he knows of his reputation, and he had a huge respect for him. And so we did, perhaps against some people might have said against the better judgment. Everyone was like, why are you going there? Because it had a reputation of being very blokey and not terribly cerebral, shall we say. It was seen as, perhaps they didn't quite appreciate actually what goes into things like Elo Tosh, Goda Toshiba and Ariston and the actual huge amount of craft and stuff that actually went into those ads. But when you put it next to Levi's that were doing Nick Kamen in The Laundrette at that time, you can see how people went, really?
And were you the only lady in that department? And
I think I was when I arrived. There had been a lady. It's no reflection on them. It's my memory. I can't remember who. There was a girl team at GGT. In the initial days, but they had left by the time Damon and I joined. And Stephen Axel had just left GGT as well and set up Hal Henry, or had they gone somewhere else before that? Anyway, they had left. So not saying that they were girls, but I was just trying to get my head around the framing. So I was the only girl there for a while, but all credit. I mean, Dave, like you, was very interested in getting different sorts of people, contrary to what people think of, like, everybody was young and male and northern and straight out of art college. He liked difference. He liked, you know, people who came from another angle. He didn't want a sort of homogenized department. So he did hire other girls during the time I was there, including the great Kate Stammers.
Oh, yeah, fantastic. And so what was it like on a day-to-day basis? Because I've spoken to Dave a fair bit about that kind of time, and it's like, you know, the sort of sink or swim, but the briefs would be up on the wall, and if you could beat it, and if your work was any better than anyone else's, then it was what went forward. So I guess it was egalitarian, but at the same time, like I said, sink or swim. Is that how it felt at all?
Yes, it was sink or swim. But when you're relatively new into the business, you kind of know you don't know much. We'd only been working 18 months, couple of years, I think. So it's much easier to sink or swim if you don't have very strong views about what you're good at. You know, if you had already developed a style and you kind of had a standard that you felt was appropriate, you would have struggled there, because it really did kind of throw, there was no time to be analytical and sort of agonize. You just had to speed up and work very fast and produce a lot, and you were always in competition with other teams, so you never had a project yourself. You were always competing with two or three or even five teams. So if you were precious about ideas, you did sink, but we didn't really know what we were doing particularly, and that helped, because we didn't have any ideas of, like, oh, I don't want to do that, or, you know, that's not my style. So we just went for it. And while it was a very uncomfortable first few weeks, we thought we were doing pretty badly, to be honest, because, you know, it was just so fast. And you had this project manager, Nicole, who would come in and say, your review is, you knew what time your review was, but you were obviously desperately doing up stuff. Your review is in 10 minutes. Your review is in 5 minutes. Get in there now. In there now. And she would shout at you. and we were like, oh, all right. And it was all really stressy. And then you'd go in, and Dave would just, everybody who did our ads on A5 post-it notes, because it was a waste of paper to do something as big as A4 and time to have to draw something that big. We did it on these tiny little bits of paper. So he'd have a sort of pile of 50 ads of, at least 10 from each team, probably nearer 15, 20. And he would just kind of, like, go through like cards and just throw one to each side every now and then. And you'd go, am I in the right pile? Yeah. And then he'd have a look at the select. It was tremendously exciting. It was a bit like, oh, I don't know, like a mini X Factor without sort of shouting. And then he would pick out two, and you'd go, sometimes it'd be like, both of yours, you know, and you'd be like, yes. And then you go, this is the one we're presenting, and if that we don't get that, this is the other one. It was just fantastic. And they had an 80% sales rate on everything presented, and we were working on things like LWT and ITV, as it was, and it was LWT before I got there, and suddenly your poster would be up, you know, within weeks. So yes, it was tough, but the adrenaline and the sheer fun of it, you know, was kind of overtook all that, really.
Well, it sounds like there were loads of good briefs and it was really fun. So, but you left at some point. So did you feel like you needed to, when was it Saatchi's came calling, or what happened there?
No. First of all, Dave was sort of, I don't know, he was, his position became untenable, and I don't know if he was fired, but they hired Tim Mellors to work as creative director. So I guess, although he was a founder, and I don't know what his other title was, it could have been chairman or chief creative officer, whatever it was, he was kind of usurped by the fact they simply hired someone to do his job. There was obviously some behind the scenes things going on that we weren't aware of. They just wanted to take the other two partners, Greenlease and Gold, I guess, wanted to take the agency in a different direction. And this was horrifying for us, because, like all cult as we were. We were passionate about the department and passionate about Dave and his, you know, because obviously things had changed a lot by then. By that time, Damon and I were very senior. We were on the board. We were allowed, before we weren't allowed to work together. You were just put with people randomly, which was also a bit hairy because, you know, suddenly I was working with people like Paul Grubb and I was quite scared of him, really. And Dave Waters and Dave Cook. And, you know, so it was doubly scary that you were kind of like, what do I know compared to these people? But by this time we were allowed to work together and we loved it. And so it was very upsetting when Dave went. And we knew we had to go then. We just didn't, it wasn't anything against Tim Mellors, didn't really know much about him, but it wasn't what we'd signed up for. And actually, we didn't go straight to Saatchi's. It was the recession, really bad recession at the end of the 80s. There were no jobs really going. And so I'm not saying this is, but Mike Chafron hired us at Legas Chafron Davis Trott, who was doing, they were doing quite nice stuff, actually. I don't know if you remember the
guide dogs.
Yeah, what was it? You don't remember anything?
Guide dogs for the blind or something? Was that him?
What was that?
The one for the guide dogs where it goes, not every man can see, but...
dog can make the man see, but a dog can. Yeah. That was actually, he did that when he was at Saatchi's. No, he did something for the... with all the politicians singing. It was quite radical at the time. He got politicians and put a Bananarama song to it, and I can't quite remember it. But anyway, it was quite edgy. He was a really good art director. He was different, and the agency was kind of like young and exciting. So we went there, but I'm afraid we only stayed 6 months. And then Paul Arden phoned us up and said, do you want to come over and be creative group heads? So we did.
Yeah, so Saatchi's in the, I guess, early 90s at this point must have been a pretty interesting proposition as well. I mean, the Saatchi's was the only known agency, and probably still is, to the British public. And I think its reputation then was, pretty high. So what was it like? And what was it like working with Paul Arden?
It was, it was great in that he's one of those people you have to work for. Dave Trott, Paul Arden, if you could, John Webster, David Abbott, John Hegarty. These are people, if you can get anywhere near, you've got to get near them. And it was the most difficult and frustrating, and he made Dave look like a positive pussycat. He's the only person I felt like really angry with, because he just would really wind you up, Paul Arden, because he was running a very big mainstream agency, and his whole creative reputation rested on him being really extraordinary and getting extraordinary work out of what was a massive lumbering, you know, with huge accounts with British Airways and British Rail, as it was then, and all these things. And he, you know, he had Tony Kaye working there when Tony Kaye was absolutely seen as a no-hoper, and he did the fantastic British Rail ads with Tony Kaye, and then Tony Kaye had also done the Cat, the Mouse and the Dog for Real Fires. So, you know, you have to be quite mad or keep that fresh brain amongst all this sort of, you know, bureaucracy going on. And that's, he did what he had to do to stay mad, if you like, and fresh. He was like a child. And that's a really rare thing.
Yeah.
Really rare.
So, the work I know of your time there is the British Airways press stuff you did that got a DNAD nomination for copy. I guess I'd like to ask what your approach to writing is, and maybe this will change over the course of the other agencies and that kind of stuff, because your reputation is of being one of the best actual writers. And I kept looking through DNAD and feeling really sad that you'd get a DNAD nomination. But it didn't turn into a pencil. Oh my God, Mary's got another DNAD nomination. Why are they not giving her a pencil? But I think it's fair to say that, you know, the writing definitely improved. So did you feel like there was, I don't know, something that happened that made you into a better actual writer? Or was it just an organic process that happened through your career?
Yeah, no, I definitely got better when I had children. When I got married and had children, I got better Which of course most people think, oh my God, you know, some people, I remember, you know, certain female copywriters not just going, I'm really worried about having children because I think I'm going to just lose all my creativity because, you know, I'm going to be just knee deep in nappies and stuff. But I did get much better. I was never a great writer to begin with. I was quite good at ideas. And because I had, you know, I'd done English and I've always been a really keen reader, I had a pretty good vocabulary and I could work a good line. But I was never, I don't think, particularly a good writer. I can remember coming to write some copy for Dave Trott, and I wrote it all kind of like quite seriously and straight. And he said, no, you need gags. Just put some gags in, you know. Like, make it a whole lot of headlines. You don't have to, it's not a kind of like, you're not, you know, we're talking about, it was probably a trade ad for Mazda or something, you know, just put a laugh in. So I would always try and make every sentence interesting and fun, unless it was a very serious subject. And I would always sort of try and put myself into being a person. So I think, who's talking, who's writing this, who's talking on this RSPCA ad, or who's talking on this British Airways ad, or, you know, just be the most fun person you could be that was suitable for that tone of voice, and make sure that, and if you, and be whimsical, you know, every people, they're looking to be entertained. And I was a big fan of writers, journalists like Clive James and Julian Barnes, who were TV critics on The Observer. And they were just so fucking funny. You know, they wrote, you know, they didn't have to be funny all the time. Sometimes they were kind of like, they hated stuff, but they were funny whether they were hating something, whether they were passionate about something, or whether it was they were talking about a comedy. They were always funny. And I thought, that's what I want to be like. Not that I got anywhere near those heady heights, but that was my idea.
I guess, what was coming over the horizon? Was it the split at Saatchi's? Was it the same as the split at GGT? And that's what changed that place?
Actually, not. We were headhunted by David Abbott just before the whole split and everything kicked off. I mean, to be honest, at Saatchi's, we just got stuck on British Airways, which is a fantastic account to get stuck on. But it is a very much a... especially then, when Virgin was the sort of underdog, it's pretty serious, and there's not a huge amount of fun to be had, or we found it quite hard to make a lot of fun things. So we were getting a little bit stuck in a rut, and we were winning some awards, and that was nice, but it's more than that. We wanted to change. We wanted to work on lots of different accounts and not just one. You very much had to carve your niche out at Saatchi's, because otherwise it's like, well, who am I and where am I? Big, big department. So David Abbott actually headhunted us, and literally we just signed the dotted line when it all kicked off, and the split came, and Maurice and Charles went off and made M&C Saatchi. And David, which is an indication of his great decency, phoned up Jeremy Sinclair or someone and said, look, I really didn't know this was happening. I hope it doesn't look like I'm stealing your staff, because I had no idea. And they were like, no, you know, absolutely. Very few other people would make that call, but he did. He was such a decent man.
Yeah, I mean, obviously many stories of what a wonderful human being he was. But, I mean, did you feel, I guess, to me, he is one of those very few people who's an iconic sort of genius of advertising. So did he ring you up personally? How did that happen? And how did you feel when you got the call from someone like David?
Yeah, I mean, in those days, again, it was sort of, I seem to remember we got a call through the headhunter, through probably Liz Harold or Kenna Kendall or whoever is the headhunter there, because he was very sensitive to, I mean, I think when Paul Arden did it, I think Paul just phoned us up and said, it's time, you've got to come here. I should have asked you before, now you need to come, that sort of thing. Whereas David was much more politic and everything. I think he got Liz to sound us out and check we were happy and then come in, and he chatted so that there were none of those awkward conversations like, I'm going to give you this much money. He did it all through a headhunter. But he was very keen, and he felt that we would fit in well with the culture. And funnily enough, Damon's father was less keen on us going there. He actually, he worked with David, and he was kind of like the polar opposite to David in some ways. because although Ron was a very suave and cultured and charming person, I think he always felt he was a slightly more rough-edged than David, and that David was so charming and so, like, you know, delighted to meet you. And that, I think Ron always thought, yeah, you know. But we felt that we'd worked for Dave, and we'd learned so much from him from all sorts of ways, creatively and marketing-wise. We'd worked for Paul, and we'd learned a whole bunch more of just letting go and stop being so controlling and, you know, stop kind of like logicalizing everything into a corner, which was a slight danger that we had. And he just freed us all up. And we just thought David was a really nice next step to kind of broaden out into perhaps a bit more grown up.
Yeah.
By then we've been working 10 years or whatever. And we thought, yeah, maybe we started to sort of find out who we were a bit and go, yeah, I can see what we could do stuff on that. It takes a while, I think, to find out who you are. And it just seemed the right time to get his sort of input.
And that was sort of, what was it, 94, 95, that kind of time?
Yeah, 95, yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, I remember it happening because I remember the whole MNC thing happening while I was just ending university. So it was quite uppermost in my mind, because I was sort of going W.H. Smith and trying to re-campaign for free and stuff like that. But I also was very aware of the incredible work AMV was doing at that time. And, you know, I didn't arrive until 98, so I kind of missed that time. But I remember when we were at college, because I was at Watford 95, 96, but looking across at AMV and going, oh my God, the work is just constantly incredible. Did you feel a sense, particularly with so many great teams there as well, that you were part of a really incredible department and a great agency at, I guess, one of its peak times?
I really did, because it had merged with BBDO, which brought in Tom and Walter. I mean, it had always been a great print ad and a print agency and, you know, and TV agency, but it had got very much that senior feel with the likes of Richard and John Horton and you know, the grown-up sort of people. But they'd merged with the BBDO and brought and got Tom and Walter and Nick Bell and I don't know where they'd all come from, but there was a definite younger vibe. There were two floors and it was literally the more senior people upstairs and the more junior people downstairs. We were in the next door office, Tom and Walter, and they had just done, you know, Dunlop. And I mean, everything they did was amazing. And their kind of passion and anarchy, really. I mean, they worked. They never did anything other than work. They were just so dedicated. But they were also different, you know. They were brave and did things differently. And the best thing is that David Abbott loved it. Now, you might think that he would go, well, I'm not sure, you know, bath plugs for nipples in an ad. And it is a sadomasochistic ad, let's face it. And he said, it's fantastic. And he did the opposite of hold you back. He just gave you the tools and off you went. And that's very different if you think about how I started with Dave Trott. He did give us the tools, but he also made sure that he kept a strong hand on the tools. So this, you know, suddenly you're in a grown-up place with exciting people doing very exciting work, some incredible writers and art directors of a really senior caliber, and the wherewithal to do it, you know, the permission to go off and make your own mistakes. So that was very exciting.
And in comparison to the, I was just going to say that the sink or swim, every man for himself nature of GGT must have been quite different, because unless things changed enormously when I got there, it was kind of one team, one brief at AMV. So how did that experience kind of differ?
Yeah, I mean, I have never had a problem competing for briefs. I don't know if all creatives are the same, but all the creatives I know, it's not enough to win it. It's really nice to beat someone else as well. You know, it's just, it's just lovely to be better. I was never one of those like, oh my God, we've got to go somewhere where it's my brief. And obviously having been a creative group head at the last two agencies, three agencies actually, I suppose, you know, I was used to allocating you know, the work as and you know, as and we felt fit. So it wasn't like, thank God we've got our own briefs. But obviously it's bloody nice. Even The Economist ads, as I'm sure you probably remember from when you were there, or maybe they changed it by the time you got there, but you had your own Economist brief. No one else was allowed to work on it. Can you believe that?
No, I didn't get that. When I was there, it was, you know, everyone could have a go at The Economist. But
I think sense.
That might have been post-Peter, because I was going to ask, were you there when the transition happened where Peter became head of the department? And if so, what was that like?
I remember it as being pretty seamless, actually. I mean, you know, David was great, but he left you fairly autonomous once he'd approved the work. It was pretty much down to you until he saw the edit. As far as I remember, that's the next time you went into his office. So it wasn't like, you know, when Dave Trott left, it's like your parent dying or something, because, you know, it was so hands-on and the whole relationship was so intense, you know. So it was awful that Dave left, but it was seamless, and he would make sure of that. And Peter, bless him, I would still work with him now, you know. He probably would admit it himself that he didn't know what he didn't know, and he just stepped up to the mark, you know, fearlessly, and did all the things, and probably found it incredibly hard, and he probably was having sleepless nights about it. But I didn't particularly notice that things changed drastically. I think a couple of, I remember there was one time where Damon and I had done some work, and we gave it to the, for some reason it went to the account people before it went to Peter, which is a bit of a no-no, and he did tell us off then. I think he felt we were being disrespectful. It was probably just an oversight, I think. You know, but he got the respect. He was a really, really good creative director, and he also meant that we could all start to being kind of more senior ourselves, and we became group heads, I think. Maybe that was when maybe Damon had left then. I started having babies fairly shortly after I got to Abbot Mead. And again, they were so ahead of their time, in that I remember girls getting pregnant at Saatchi's. There were girl coffee writers. They never reappeared. You'd see them getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it was as though they burst and disappeared because they never came back. They just did not like people having babies, or they never really invited them back, or something happened. Whereas when I got pregnant at Abbot Mead, probably only 2 years after I got there, or 2-3 years, I was on the board. So you had 6 months maternity pay, full pay, I think, and then they would keep your job for another 6 months. So you could have a year off. It was radical stuff in those days. We're going back to 97. And I came back and said I would like to work a four-day week. Again, absolutely unheard of, and probably at Saatchi's they would have said, well, that's the same as handing your notice in. And Peter said, I absolutely want you to work a four-day week, because I know you're going to work your bollocks off on those 4 days, and you'll probably still be thinking on the fifth. He was very acute about giving people so-called favors, and they would then repay you really a lot. And so I did. I went down to a four-day week, but actually, of course, I was working 5 days really. And I started working, Damon left to go and be creative director at Lowe's. And I started working with Andy Mackay. And that was a huge plus to my career, because much as I loved working with Damon, we were quite similar. We were quite word orientated. And Andy just comes from a complete art directional, photographic, not a big talker, but massive creative intuition. And it was just a really happy marriage, that.
And was that, were you given a choice of someone to recruit, and that was the person you favoured, or were they bringing Andy in anyway and they thought you'd make a good team?
No. I was given a choice, and I was told that Rosie Arnold was interested in moving from BBH, which was really quite amazing, because you know, she was kind of like right-hand man with John Hegarty. And we went out and got on very well. And I was also talking to Andy as well. I can't quite remember where he was at that time. But, and P- Peter was very keen, actually, that, I mean, he was happy whoever came, but he was keen to get Rosie, probably for the same reasons we're talking about, apart from the fact she's a genius, more women, you know. Mm. We had Di and me, and I can't remember, I don't think there were any other women. Can't remember any. And, you know, it would have been a big boost and a great coup as well. And I got on really well with Rosie, but I just felt with Andy that we were so different that it would be a really interesting mix. And it was kind of like, it just, you know, worked for me. And I had to phone Rosie up and say, Rosie, I'm sorry, you know, I've decided to go with Andy. And she was very cool about it and funny about it too. But I sort of thought, she's never really going to leave. I thought, she might be stringing me along, but she's not really going to leave. And so it's taken however long, 20 years or whatever it is, but she's just gone then, hasn't she?
Yeah, well, she's at AMV, isn't she?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. So she's finally gone to AMV.
Yeah.
So 15, 20 years after she nearly did. So maybe she would have gone there. It's hard to imagine her going that far back. But yes, it was her. It was between Rosie and Andy, and I chose Andy.
Right. And if you were creative group heads at GGT and at Saatchi's, I mean, my memory of AMV was that there wasn't that formality of position, and you and I don't know if you were in that position or not, but you know, you go and see senior teams and they'd kind of tell you how to make your work better here and there. But was that like I don't know if you felt like there was you wanted to still have that formal title or something, or did you feel that was missing from what you got to do?
No, I've always felt that my title as copywriter, whether I was a creative director or whether I was group head, I always felt I was a copywriter. I mean, obviously, we were doing a lot more TV then, so but I still felt that copy was what I was about. So I didn't miss the title, and I do really like doing workshops, and I do like junior teams, and I really enjoyed them working to it. I mean, I do remember quite a lot coming in and working to us, but as you say, I think it was more on a project by project basis, wasn't it, rather than, like, for instance, a pitch or a rather large piece of work which required radio, TV, print, lots of different things, then you would be allocated a junior or a couple of junior teams rather than you running an account. That's what it was when I was there. But I do remember doing anti-smoking stuff with some juniors, and I really enjoyed it a lot. You know, you've been in both positions, as I have, as a junior and as a senior. And there's really nothing better than teaching people who are bloody keen to learn. You know, I mean, these are people who desperately want to get better. It's not like trying to teach in a secondary modern, you know, it's fun, and they're already bright and pretty brilliant to have got their either placement or their first job. So it's a really fun thing to do, and I always really enjoyed it.
From my point of view, as a younger creative there, I found that what tended to happen between, say, me and Paul or Tom, and you would just go, my God, there are so many amazing teams up there on the seventh floor. Pick one and, like, get them to make your work better. So you'd go, does this feel maybe Stephen Vick, or does this feel like John Gorson, Nick Worthington? Or, you know, or if you respected their work so much, you'd want to go and see them. And I think that sort of continued, because I don't remember anyone saying when Dave Dye came in, Dave is now a formal creative director on something, but he'd be sort of there and you'd go, oh, can I show you some work? And it was just the most amazing resource for a junior creative to go and see how Steve Hudson would approach a problem, or you would approach a problem, or, you know, and then Paul and Nigel. So from my point of view, there wasn't a formal thing, but you off your own back go and see some of the best creatives in the country, if not the world.
Mm. Yes, I've forgotten. Nick Worthington as well was there with gosh, what's the name of his partner?
It was John Gorse.
John Gorse. Yeah, both. I mean, amazing, amazing team. And as you say, Steve and Vic. I mean, these were just like the top people, weren't they? I mean,
Abbott Paul and Malcolm were there.
Very senior, and they would hire very good, and everybody wanted to work there. And I would go there. I would go in and talk to Steve and Vic or Dave Dye. Or, you know, or any of those people. It wasn't just people who were older than you. It was often people who were practically younger than you, but they were just so bloody good. And there was competition between you, but it was really much more of a kind of, like, we were quite proud to be at Abbott Mead, weren't we? And it was all sort of we sort of felt we were at quite a special place. And that whole thing of being nice, you know, I mean, I do look back, because I did have a reputation before, well, I don't know me, but before, of being, you know, a bit scary and a bit shouty, or a bit kind of like grumpy, I don't know, just kind of like passionate, I suppose. And I just loved Abbott Mead because it did make a big feature of being nice. And I just believe that's a really, really important thing. I think there are times when you have to drop nice to get what's important. But I think when you're really good, you could be really good and really nice. And it was a very enjoyable process, the whole thing.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, as me being a writer as well, it was a very copywriter agency. Obviously, there was David at the top of it. But when I bought the DNAD copybook, at one point or another, whether it is Mark Antonio or Richard Foster or you or Nigel or Peter Suter or Paul Malcolm Duffy and Jeremy Carr, there were all these really, really great writers there, and it felt like that was an important thing. That, I mean, again, what a resource. You could go and just see Tony Cox with your copy. You could just go and see someone with the copy. It was, and that was an incredible thing as well. So I don't know if you ever felt like it was a writerly place at all, but having David there, I guess, might have done that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a writerly place. I mean, Tim Riley, you know, is a title one, you know, one of the best writers around as well. And he very much made, you know, his presence felt. And it was, I mean, it had a huge respect for writing. But, you know, as you say, you had Paul Belford and Dave Dye.
Yeah.
And Nick Worthington, I mean, really, really, and Braze and stuff, really outstanding art directors. Certainly didn't skimp on them, and they were highly respected. But it was, I suppose, a little bit, not intellectual, maybe a bit posh or something. It definitely had that feeling of, you know, how important the written word. It didn't mean to say you had to be all kind of noncy and middle class about it, but you did, you know, you really did love words. And I have to say, I find that not so obvious on juries and things now, on the copy jury. It's great to be disrespectful about language, especially when you're trying to do advertising, do something different. But the Americans do that so well, don't they? They're not at all kind of literary, but their copywriting is bloody brilliant. But I feel that the last couple of juries I've been on copy juries, there's a certain disinterest in it, not from everybody, but it's not so universally loved, I think, as it is perhaps it used to be, or perhaps it was at Abbott Mead. Yeah, it was a writer's haven.
Yeah, and I think, talking of which, I would have thought the highlight of your career would have been writing three words, Make Poverty History. So how did that sort of, because I remember working on it a bit myself, but only after you'd written that line. So did Peter say, hey, we need a line to brand this entire thing, or what happened?
Yeah. And then that's where another place where Abbott Mead is so good, in its how the departments work together. And the planning department, I was thought, was outstanding there. And the way they work very closely with creatives there, which is not unheard of, but I thought it was exemplary, really, Abbott Mead. And Bridget Angier, who's the head of planning there at that time, I think it was before Craig joined, worked very close with Peter, and Peter was close with Richard Curtis, and Richard Curtis had a dream or a vision that was so ambitious that it almost seemed mad at the time, of like, yeah, we want to stop everybody being poor by 2050 or something. And it was all a bit kind of like, yeah, well, that's going to happen. But Bridget, the great thing was, it was the planning behind it was so good. Bridget just embraced the whole ambition, and she said, you know, it's, although it seems like a massive thing, we just need something that is really going to, you know, aspirational, inspirational, we're going to change things, you know. And the brief was, we would like to make poverty a thing of the past. My job, maybe I'm imagining that, but that's how I remembered roughly what it was. And we didn't do 20 different strategies, you know. She just sort of said, just, you know, go for it. And I can remember at that time I'd moved up to Suffolk, so I was commuting 4 days a week, I think, and I was writing quite a lot on the train. And I can remember coming back on the train after the brief, and I wrote about 6 or 7 lines, and everybody, I don't know who else, but I know Tim Riley was also briefed to do the same thing, possibly another team as well, I can't remember, and one of them was, and I'll be honest, it said, let's make poverty history. It didn't actually say make poverty history, it said, let's make poverty history. And there was some others like putting your money where your mouth is. So it wasn't all about the high end. It was things about, you know, giving and doing and changing and things like that. And we handed these, literally just emailed them into Peter, and came out. And I think Tim will verify this. Tim also, I think I showed him, that's what, I showed Tim my ideas or something. When the work went in, Tim also had let's make poverty history on his list. And so Peter went, oh, great, you guys, you've come up with a great line. We love this line. This is the line. And I said to Tim, I wrote that fucking line. I told you about it. He said, yeah, I know, but it's such a good line. I thought, I'm not going to not put it down because it's the right line to do. Which was, but bless him, he didn't go, I'm stealing it. He just, I think he genuinely thought it was the best line. So he wrote it down.
Yeah.
So there could have been a moment where it was jointly copywritten, but Tim, he wasn't trying to steal it. I think he was giving it his stamp of approval, but it did, I think, and I might be wrong on this, but I seem to remember it did go in on two bits of paper. And Bridget and Peter and everybody else at Abbott Mead said, this is the line, let's get rid of let's, that's a stupid idea, make poverty history. I think it was Paul Belford who did an amazing bit of art direction where poverty was faint, so it was make history, make poverty history.
Yeah.
It was a line that translated everywhere, it had a rhythm to it, and it caught fire, you know, and lots of people worked to make it catch fire. But all credit, because Richard Curtis, he's an amazing guy, but he's like anyone, he doesn't know what's right always, and he's a ditherer, and he was oh, I don't know about this line, are you sure? But it was Peter and Bridget and AMV who kept him on track and said, you just got to go with it. And writing something is relatively easy, keeping it on track, that's the really hard bit, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
That line could have just ended in a bin and no one, you know, they could have done something completely different, and would anybody, you know, it's such a knife edge, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it was Make Poverty History. I didn't think we all had a sense of quite how enormous it was all going to be. Because, you know, as I think you said, Nelson Mandela is standing in front of your line, or maybe even said it, I don't know.
He said it. Make Poverty History. And every time Peter would sort of phone me and go, well, turn on the telly, there's something about, and there would be some other amazing person from around the world going, Make Poverty History. And Bob Geldof and Nelson Mandela, it was all getting a bit surreal, you know.
Yeah, and I remember in the bits that Daryl and I were doing, we made sort of Africa into a footprint because there was this like walk to freedom or something like that. And then we're watching the Scottish leg of it, and George Clooney's got a lanyard around his neck with the thing on it. And I'm just going, oh my God, this is just like never. The other thing, I don't want to tell the story because I'm never going to interview myself, but I think this is quite funny. Peter at one point said to me and Daryl, do you want to come round to Richard Curtis's office? Because we're just working out some things for Live 8. And of course, Daryl and I were like, yeah, I don't know what you're doing, but yeah, this is really cool. So we sat around his sort of table with about 10 or 15 people, including, I think, Peter's kids and maybe Richard's kids if he had any. And Richard said, right, what's going to be the final song that they all sing at the end of Live 8? What, we need to work out what that song is going to be. And I'm sitting here going, oh my God, if I get this right, I'm basically choosing what Paul McCartney and The Who and Pink Floyd are going to sing at the end of Live 8. And I didn't end up choosing Hey Jude because there were lots of, like, there's lots of logical reasons why Hey Jude wasn't the right song, because it was like, what's it got to do with anything really? And I remember Peter saying Heroes by David Bowie, but like no one really knows the words to Heroes. So it's a very difficult one. The thing about, if ever you get the opportunity to do this again, Hey Jude, obviously the lyrics at the end are na 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 Hey Jude, which everyone knows, and you can just have them sing it forever and ever and ever, and that's great. But being in that room, I was just like, oh my God, this is like, this is where this decision is happening right now. Like, what's Paul McCartney anyway? So I think Make Poverty History was an interesting, almost like footnote to Abbott Mead's general client list. But my God, I mean, what a privilege to have worked on that account.
It was also, it was still pre-digital, the pre-digital age. I mean, obviously we all had computers, but the internet was relatively in its infancy. So there was no social media, and there was no Twitter or quick ways of actually like passing things around. And perhaps for that reason, you know, all we had were little plastic armbands. And perhaps for that reason, it just took off. I mean, I've done quite a few ads that people of a certain age, they will know those ads. But the only thing I have never... You know, I've met 100% of people who've heard of it is Make Poverty History. and that includes young people and old people. It's the only thing where I'm never going, you know, I've never met someone who didn't know about it. And that's extraordinary. I mean, that is a, yes, I hope it's a lot to do with the line, but if I'm honest, you know, it's to do with how it caught fire and caught imagination. And it was a great sense of optimism and a real determination to change. I mean, couldn't we just use that now?
Yeah. Make Trump history. Anyway, no, let's not get into that. I guess at that point, so you'd moved to Suffolk and you were coming down 4 days a week. Was there a point where you transitioned into being a bit more, I guess, freelancing? You still work for AMV sometimes, don't you? Or
not since, no, once Adrian and Alex. Is it Adrian Alex?
Oh, yeah.
Alex and Adrian, isn't it?
Yeah, that's
it. The creative directors there now. Yeah. Once they took over, they wanted to rearrange the department quite drastically in terms of the way they wanted to run it, quite rightly. And Braze went upstairs. They pretty much wanted to cut off the freelance thing then and employ more of their own people, which they have done to great success, I have to say. It's, you know, the agency's doing brilliantly. So I haven't really done a lot to do with the London agency, Abbotmead, for probably 4 years now. But I do actually occasionally work for BBDO in New York and go out and do workshops and stuff like that. So I did go, I think once in about 2005, it was certainly after my 10-year patch that I left to go freelance. But again, it was very serendipitous because the internet by then had really taken hold. Mm. And it was very, very easy to send scripts and films and, you know, the whole uploading and downloading was getting a lot easier. And, you know, 90% of creative directors don't really want a creative. They just sort of clutter up the space and make messes, drink coffee and generally hang around. They want the scripts and they want the ideas and they want them to be right for the client. They don't want, you know, to have to spend ages trying to get people to understand the brand and stuff. And I knew all the Abbotmead brands very, very well. I'd done Maltesers and BT and, you know, a lot of the Yellow Pages, obviously, when it was Yellow Pages, and a lot of the big stuff I'd worked on. So I knew the brands extremely well. So they knew they could pretty much give me a brief and it would come back as a script that was workable. So that worked very, very well for quite a long period of time, probably 6, 7 years, 8 years, maybe longer.
Yeah, and I my own personal experience of freelancing was it was ever so slightly annoying that you had to find the next gig and chase down your invoices and do the job as well. How have you found it in terms of, like, finding those extra gigs? Because obviously you've got a great reputation, but, you know, getting it out there, has that been easy, smooth experience?
Well, I'm just the worst self-promoter. I mean, you know, the internet's been very good to me in terms of communicating and being able to send my work, but I have been pretty crap with the internet and things like my website hasn't been updated for 10 years probably, and I'm not a great LinkedIn, I mean I do LinkedIn, but I'm not a great Twitter user and stuff, and yet it has worked out fairly well because, well, I think it is a reputation. When people think I need a copywriter, I need to write a really nice piece of copy, sometimes when it's things like Dove, you see, I got involved a lot with that. Sometimes if it's about for women, because I did a lot of the Tampax stuff when I was at AMV. So, you know, people are looking for a writer. My name does still come up. And also, perhaps sadly, but happily for me, the lack of female writers has played in my favour. If there were like 25 female senior copywriters that everyone could fish from, I'd probably be out of a job.
Yeah, it is. It's a funny thing that we were just talking about before I switched the recorder on. That you know, in terms of finding people for this podcast who have had a significant position somewhat in the industry, particularly over the time that I've been there. I mean, does it feel like it's changed at all in terms of not just women but other minorities? Actually, I think it's probably even worse, actually.
Yeah, I would say that on the minorities and different ethnic background stuff, it's probably even worse. It was always very, very poor. And obviously, I'm not sitting in agencies every day, although I do go into them. And I have to say, you know, I don't see a huge diversity of women or different ethnicities or ages even. You know, it is very, still very much of a male, white age between 25 and 40. And, you know, it hasn't changed that much. I find it particularly weird in creative departments where it has always been a meritocracy, creative departments. It really doesn't matter what you look like, largely, perhaps a bit more important now, but really not that important. Or, you know, how old you are, or what you dress like or anything, because you are producing a product, you're not actually selling yourself. So it is even more extraordinary that there aren't more women. And I think it's a little simplistic to say it's simply because men hire men. That's possible as a starting point, you know, that to get in. But I am under the impression that quite a few mixed teams or female teams do start. They just don't seem to stick it. Is that right?
Well, I mean, I it would only be my anecdotal kind of reflection on that rather than any real figures. But I think you are right. I definitely see women at the starting off point, and whether it goes back to that Saatchi and Saatchi anecdote you were saying, and when they have babies, not that the agencies don't want them back, but maybe they just don't want to come back, because although advertising is interesting and you can get very into it, and there's a lot to kind of recommend from it, and if it's something that you want to do, it's great, but taking that time off can perhaps give you a perspective where you go, is this what I want to do? Maybe I want to change and do something else. Because advertising has also always been a springboard into lots of other careers for a lot of people. Everyone from Hugh Grant to Alec Guinness to Salman Rushdie to Faye Weld. You know, whether it's writing or something else, it feels like it's had a sort of temporariness at the beginning. There are those of us who do stick it out and go through with it. But I think there's something about it that has a certain freedom that means that some people just do it for a bit and then go and do something else. Maybe.
Yeah, that's true. I had another sort of theory as well, which is that it's a very egotistical business, really. You know, you do need to enjoy praise and success. It helps, doesn't it? You know, it's lovely when you do something, everyone goes, that's brilliant. You know, how did you do it? If you enjoy that, you know, you keep wanting that buzz. Well, I think a lot of women, when they have children, they kind of grow out of it a bit. They realise that actually it's rather empty and shallow, and they get their buzz elsewhere. You know, as you know, I have to say, I've never grown out of it. I still really like getting praised for doing good things. And I love advertising people. I enjoy their company, even if I'm working remotely. I like, they're always bright and interesting and different and energized. And I really like that environment. I can remember, you know, arriving in the creative department, might have been FCB or certainly GGT, and it's all full of misfits and weirdos and strange people, and some, you know, out of school at 15 and some, you know, come back at the age of 40. And I thought, God, yeah, this is where I belong, because everybody's different. Nobody's the same. And we're all misfits and we all fit together. And I found a great sense of belonging. I don't know if all women feel that they want to be a part of the misfits.
Well, I think
so. Maybe they just grow out of it and they go, you know what, I could actually much rather put my creativity in a different place and start a shop or a, you know, an online business or, you know, something different. Instead of putting up with, you know, I mean, because the bad times as well, you know, having your work endlessly turned down or seeing great ideas being frittered away, or even just, you know, all that work you put into something and it's never quite good enough. And it can be a bit heartbreaking too, can't it?
Yeah, I guess it can. I mean, but I think most creative endeavors have that, whether you're writing a TV series or painting pictures, there's going to be an element of, if not rejection, then you're offering it up to somebody for some sort of opinion, whether it's the public or a boss or whatever it happens to be. So I guess that's just the job, really, and it's the job of creating anything out of nothing. But yeah, I think that's an interestingly bittersweet note perhaps to end on. We've done an hour, and my my file size on WordPress tends to like an hour. If we go much more than that, it starts getting annoying in terms of fitting it in. But I think we've covered most of the things we wanted to do. I did ask, and I have asked other people in having this conversation, if they want to say something, anything we haven't covered at the end of it, and you're very welcome to do that if you want.
No, I can't think of anything. I must say, I listened to Mark Denton's and Vicky Maguire's things, and their stories are so much more interesting than mine. They've done something like some mad fun things, haven't they? So I hope mine won't be too pedestrian compared to theirs.
Well, I think everyone's, you can take what you want out of all the different stories, and whether Mark's seen a clairvoyant or Vicky's opened a sweet shop or whatever it happens to be, I think there's still a huge amount to be learned from, the career you've had as a very successful woman and copywriter in this business, because I think there can't be more than a handful of people who've done what you've done, and I think your perspective on it is really valuable for people.
Well, I would just get one thing. If women are being put off by having, feel that it's a struggle to have children and do the job, and they find that off-putting, I would absolutely say that having children, and I have four, two of my own and two stepchildren, full on, two boys and two girls, having children has actually totally made it much better and made me a much better creative. So I'm hoping that if they, are worried about that they shouldn't, they'll be a lot better for it too.
Great. Well, that sounds like a good positive note to end on then. And thanks very much for your time. And I'll pop this up in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Good luck with your plumbing. I hope it's all gone well and he hasn't run off with your fittings and fixtures.
I hope so as well. He left like about 45 minutes ago and I didn't see like anything valuable under his arm. So I'm crossing my fingers. He left his card as well. Come on. I'm going to be able to track him down. So fingers crossed for that. And have a good Saturday evening. And I'll send this along when it's done.
Great. Thank you. I really enjoyed it. It's been fun.
Yeah. Thanks, Mary.
Okay. Take care.
You too. Bye.
This is a podcast to watch Christmas.